Hello, everyone, and welcome to this breakdown of the meta of Grand Prix Toledo. I am that damn pipsqueak, your host, and once again joined by Dodger.
Hello.
Grand Prix Toledo is special because it's kind of like a post-new set GP in the amount of, like, fresh new ideas, because Crotation happened as well as New Horizons dropped. But there's some pretty solid through lines from last GP into this one. So
I can think of one through line in particular.
Yeah. So in the show notes will be a copy of the amazing chart that Elmkino made. Once again, many thanks to him for these incredibly detailed meta breakdowns. So this GP is bringing up a whopping 40 players, which is less than last GP, but it's still a absolutely insane number of people to come and play in this priceless custom format. So looking at it, we have a pretty stark amount of aggro. Once again, aggro being the most played archetype with 13 different players. But there's a lot more diversity amongst these aggro decks this time. Whereas last GP, it was a lot of red-black burn. This time, the blue-red burn deck is only representing three copies, which I think is probably a sign that the various different nerfs and reworks we assigned towards burn cards kind of landed.
I think also part of it is just that there were new cards that came out and people wanted to try them, but I think it's a combination of those two.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that we also have two different people representing Mystery of the Crash Craft, one of them basically slotting it into a fairly traditional burn list and the other one doing more of a build around, I think is a really exciting thing to look at.
Yeah, I think the other factor is we don't have as many new players who are like,
just give me whatever.
Burn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just give me the best deck you can. But this time, the second most played archetype, by a decent margin, is aggro control, with 10 players. And there's five people on Rug Tempo, so apparently my preaching the gospel of that deck might have gone a little too far.
I thought it was more than five. I'm kind of surprised it's only five.
Yeah, I think the combination of the deck tech and some number of these people being new players, or people who were too busy to brew up a new deck, or Infinity Chef, who had a really good run with it last GP. Like, it makes sense for there to be this many Rug Tempo people. But
I made a deck tech for Unearth, and no one's playing that.
That's true. Did that deck get any cards, like, nerfed immediately after you won a GP with it?
Nope, the deck is still
the deck is still
weak.
Exactly the same?
Yep.
Alright, yeah, more people should be on that. I actually played against Dork in Distress, who was playing it in a league match.
Oh, okay. I converted one.
Yeah.
It was a win.
Which I ended up drawing too many lands and dying game one to a absolutely gigantic Perform of Ambition. But all three games, I was able to corpse bed a turn two Unearth. So that, I think, accurately describes how that match more or less played out.
Okay. Actually, yeah, that deck gets so much worse when people are actually playing corpse bed.
Yeah, corpse bed is
so much worse.
Terrifying. And after aggro control, we have seven people on mid-range. Two people are playing kind of the same Mardu Walker's Dawson's Creek style list.
Mm-hmm.
Scribble in particular is on record for saying that it basically is the MSC import of one of his favorite current canon archetypes. So, of course, he was really excited to be on that this GP.
Yeah, Scribble actually messaged me and said that Dawson was his favorite Planeswalker ever.
That's awesome.
So I was very flattered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, From my experience playing against Dawson, that card is an absolute house if it gets going, and even if it doesn't get going, it usually hurts.
I think I'm very glad that I made the changes pre-release
yes.
and submission to Dawson that I did, because the original version was absolutely backbreaking, and the current version is good if you set it up, but also has like plenty of counterplay. So and also does require some amount of deck building investment to achieve his full potential. So I'm happy with how he's been doing. O10 memes aside.
The next largest archetype is combo, up at six players, which is fairly impressive. Two different people are on Abzan Persistocrats, which is basically the same list as MacGuffin's last GP winning thing, except swapping out Miner's Barracks for what is it? Grim Armory, I think is the name of the card.
Yeah,
and
it's also using Duskwood Revolutionary, very much
yep.
not how it was intended to be used.
Not even a little. So the deck is effectively, for anyone familiar with Malirapod style decks or the kind of Devoted Druid combo decks in Canon Modern or the Yawgmoth decks, there's a lot of different kind of undying combo decks in Modern, come to think of it.
This is very much a Malirapod deck, I think.
Yeah. It doesn't have the same tutor consistency, but it is very much plan A is combo out with persist creatures. Plan B is beat your opponent to death with these little persist creatures.
It's kind of like Elves meets Malirapod, basically. Does that feel
Yeah. I don't strongly agree, but I get it enough that I'm not gonna quibble about specific human archetypes.
When I just say Elves, I just mean like the plan B of Elves is just
playing with
little dudes and beat them up.
I do think that it has a worse backup plan than the last GP deck, because last GP deck had a backup plan of, you know, two power creatures for one mana that are functionally unkillable, whereas this deck is, like, one power creature for one mana that are functionally unkillable.
Math checks out.
But, sure enough, MacGuffin is on the list, and Dragon Mako along with it. And both of them, I believe, won their first round, so off to a good start. And then we have a fairly wide variety of other combo decks, which we're not going to get too deep into, but I do want to give a quick shout-out to Splashcat continuing to rep the five-color show-and-tell deck even after the loss of Leyline Alignment Field, which, to me, actually is the first thing that I've seen that really makes me feel comfortable about that ban. Like, yeah, if that deck can still exist without Leyline Alignment Field, we really did not need Leyline Alignment Field in this format.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you would have needed this deck existing still. I don't know. I mean, like, Alignment Field was fine. It's just Alignment Field plus Complex Ravager was not, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can agree with that.
Yeah.
And only three people are on hard control lists, at least as far as Elm Kino classifies them. I'll go a little bit into depth there because I don't agree with all of these classifications, but also a lot of these were kind of hard calls, so I definitely don't blame this classification. And one person, just like last GP, is on ramp. I appreciate the detail on Umkino's graph of ramp not visible at this scale.
Honestly, I feel like more people should be playing ramp.
I don't disagree. I think, so Dravos is playing ramp yet again, but this GP, since we gutted Savinay's last patch, and that was one of the things that was making the rug version even remotely feasible, along with Keen's Devoted, Dravos basically came to me like, all right, what's the plan? And I, since I only had like 3 hours before deck lists were due and my brain was fried, I was like, I'm literally just going to give you Dodger's GP winning Nihilist and replace the Keen's Devoteds with Mana Ascetics and call it a day. And also add four copies of Solar Flare to the 75. So we'll see how that pans out, but I have a pretty good feeling about that helping the aggro matchup.
Interesting the split you went with. You went with one main, two sideboard, and it looks like you
Three side.
Oh, there's three side. Looks like you cut a tutor target and a stand unassailable.
I know. I cut a stand unassailable. I think I cut.
Oh, you cut the Sang.
I think I went down. Yeah, I cut the Sang Jin.
Yeah. Fair. Sang Jin in the board was basically like for if you got a bad draw and had to cast Encounter on turn two.
Yeah.
So like, I could see the argument. I can see the argument that's like, well, you should have mulliganed that hand anyway, or something.
Yeah, I mean, basically, my logic with that is, I think that Sang Jin is good as a bridge to get you to, like, your more mid-gamey things.
Yeah.
But I think, actually, Solar Flare serves a very similar role, and the fact you can actually board it in plenty of matchups, where I really don't like having too many tutor targets in my sideboards, because it just kind of makes sideboarding way harder.
So I think,
because you just don't have as many things to bring in.
Without trying to get too into this, I think Sang Jin was actually pretty important, and I would have preferred cutting, like, one Spore Flow Protector or something.
That makes sense.
Because sometimes you just cascade into Epic Encounter off of off of your tend, and then it's like, well, anyway.
I feel like grabbing a Salem and Kerto is probably good enough, though. Or, like, Bahum. Like, you have value fours you can grab.
It kind of depends, especially since this deck is more mana hungry now, with Tyrant of Tributes costing 8 mana instead of 7.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. And Earthbreaker Behemoth going up to... No, that's still it's a 5/5, not a 6/6.
Yeah.
I was like, didn't it go up to 6 mana? No, I got the Nerf.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, like, I think this deck is really, really good still. Yeah. Tend to the Grove, Tendril Growth plus Tendril Snare is an auto win against any aggro deck, basically. And, like, the deck sideboard makes it pretty robust when you can bring in, like, you can just cut your removal spells and bring in, like, extra threats.
Yeah.
Tend to the Grove hitting Stand Unassailable is really nasty. I actually almost brought a version of Nioramp that used Endless Helpless Souls alongside Tend to the Grove. So, like, you have an 8-pack of, like, 3-mana double ramp spells, basically.
Yeah, that looked really sick, and if I was playing the list, I would probably have been on that. But Dravos wanted to be running big creatures, so this was the list I ended up putting them on. So let's talk about some of the classifications of this chart that might shift things around a little bit. I think Tropic Thunder, despite the fact it looks... Basically, I think aggro control right now is basically all decks that run Bounty of the Gardens, and I think that's probably not entirely fair. Like, I think the Tropic Thunder decks and Bant Flash both should really just be control decks. Like, those decks can't aggro you down.
I think Bant Flash in particular feels very much like a... I'm not sure what the best comparison is. It's kind of like Fires of Invention deck, if that makes sense. Because it's like, I stall till turn 4, I drop my mana doubler, and then because of how I built my deck, I'm now doing ridiculous things, but like it feels like the kind of control deck where your game plan is basically resolve this one card, and like stop your opponent from killing you before then.
I like how you went with Fire's Invention rather than the other 4-mana doubler that got banned out of that standard, i.e. Wilderness Reclamation.
Yeah, well, I feel like Angel does more Fires things than Wilderness things, because Wilderness was used to like double your mana on your end step. Whereas Angel is basically, I'm casting two things per turn.
Yeah. The other thing I would note is that Ivy's deck actually isn't on Angel of Sukor. So I actually talked to Ivy a lot about this deck before the GP. And one thing that it was trying to do was take Ruben's list, which was kind of this weird aggro control hybrid where it had like some Veilborn Meddlers and things that want to play to the board and like these tax spells, but was really clearly built to go late.
I'm looking at this deck, this is definitely a control deck.
This list is just designed to go... This deck literally runs 25 lands with double Monument of Queen. This is a deck designed to go late.
It's running late as four possible. RFEs. Yeah, like, this is a control deck for sure. but, you know, I don't blame Elmaquino for, like...
There's a lot of hard calls.
Necessarily, because, like, sometimes you do go removal spell, counterspell, Bounty Cane Dancer.
And just like, kill your opponent on turn, like, 5 or 6, yeah.
Yeah, like, so, like, I can see where that configuration comes from.
You're trying to kill by going sideways. Like, you're trying to use Bank Command and Portal Fracture and all of these things to, like, just generate incidental value idiots to murder your opponent.
Yeah. End of All Things obviously brings a lot to this archetype. Especially since you do hit 8 mana pretty frequently, and, like, having End of All Things and Recall Forgotten Eons gives you a lot of, like, redundancy in terms of finishers.
Yeah.
Which is a nice thing to have in control.
Having finishers that you can play early, that, you know, also, you're not worried about your opponent, like, countering them or whatever, because you'll just get them.
Mm-hmm.
The other
deck that I think we were a little unsure about was the Tropic Thunder deck, which is basically, like, kind of a 5-color play at instant speed, more or less, deck. That kills with Thunder Road, and I think that seems like pretty... I'm not sure I feel as comfortable calling it a aggro control deck, because, like, as far as I can tell, you're basically just a control deck with a more or less combo finish.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is Furzy took my Rug Tempo list and started tweaking it to be a Thunder Roads deck. That's, like, what inspired this. So I think it's really fair to look at it and say, oh, look at all these cards that overlap. This is, you know, clearly an offshoot of Rug Tempo, and thus it's still a tempo deck. But I think the changes Herzy made really take away from the deck's ability to, like, run people down and make it into this kind of late game monstrosity.
I think they're only overlapping like 10 cards.
Really?
Yeah, it's 4 bounties, 4 Cane Dancers, 2 Veilborns. Your deck doesn't run Cursory Glance, right?
No, it doesn't. Oh, Herzy's not running Cursory Glance. Okay, yeah. This build also changed slightly, but yeah, I agree. I don't think they're that similar anymore.
And those are like very common cards. Like,
you know, like... No. I put a trademark on those cards. If you play those cards, you're actually an offshoot of Rogue Tempo now.
It's true.
So Dodger, you want to tell us a little bit about the deck you ended up bringing to this GP?
Oh God. I'm actually pretty excited. So, I ended up. I was toying around with the Endless Helpless Souls ramp deck, which I was excited about, but I also didn't necessarily feel like I had tuned it properly. I didn't feel like I had the energy to do so. So I ended up revisiting an archetype that had been in my head for a while, which is basically just like I was looking at Canon Modern lists for inspiration because I've recently started getting back into Canon Magic, and one deck that I've seen a lot run was this kind of like very threat light, like maybe running 7 creatures plus a Lurrus, like kind of tempo slash control deck that gets to run like Unearth incidentally, as well as like just a pile of interaction to go along with your finishers. And I thought that deck was really cool. And there's so many ways to build it. So I ended up trying to come up with a similar port here where I was like, okay, I'm going to run like, you know, some Unearths, some interaction, and I picked a suite of threats that was more or less graveyard based. I was talking to Pip about it, and there were all these cards that we wanted to play, but like we had to make cuts, right? We had to make concessions. And then Pip was like, one point that I think is missing here is that the Canon version, because it has access to Lurrus, it's always going to have it's going to guarantee that it has some kind of threat to play after you've interacted with your opponent enough. And I think that so we were literally just like, hey, what if we threw in a first mate? Like, how feasible is that? And we were talking about a couple different ones. And then I think
immediately went to Marissa. I was like, oh, we have a lot of kill spells. Can we make Marissa work?
Yeah, and Marissa suffers from suffers from stuff like you can't run counter magic.
Yeah,
most counter magic. So I was like, hey, why not Holcomb? I already want to have a lot of cards in my graveyard. Holcomb will be easier to turn on because we're self-milling, right? Holcomb has solid stats, like 3/3 vigilance is not awful. He's unearthable. Just all this stuff. And like what really sealed it for me is that I was already like there were all these cards that I wanted to play. And cutting down to like the ones that were maybe the best four ofs was really hard. So I was like, hey, what if we just have a good reason to just literally play all the cards I want to play?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the thing that sealed it, where I think I was very low on Holcomb when we were doing the review. And the thing that made me realize why Holcomb works is it's the exact same principle that makes Dreamsight work. It's you have so many good things to play that you just play all of them and you meet the card's requirement. Holcomb really didn't actually hurt that much. That difficult to make that work out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when you look at the stack, like I'm not running any bad cards. And I'm running a lot of cards that kind of do similar things to each other. So you're not actually giving up that much consistency either. And I think that Holcomb is a card that as the format grows and people get used to building with it, it'll actually just get better and better because you just have more consistency available in the card pool. And more redundancy in like different kinds of effects that work. I really love that we have the first mates around because I think people will eventually discover how to use more or less all of them, which is something I really like.
I think one other thing that this deck does that I think more first mate decks need to be prepared to do is it runs Stand Unassailable in the sideboard as a four of rather than as a two of. And we talked a lot about that. But the specific logic of there are matchups where you don't want Holcomb. Mm. And so for those matchups, you shouldn't constrain yourself to building your sideboard to be Holcomb compatible. I think that's something that'll also be true for Garth decks. And to a lesser extent, it's possible it'll be true for some Hugo decks down the line. We're just eventually realizing like, oh, these are the matchups where I'm never going to take my first mate. And having X specific creature or card that violates their requirement completely changes the way the matchup plays out.
I think it's less true for Hugo because Hugo decks are so often like they really want to play Hugo on turn two. I think it could be true for like Hugo Unearth though, because that deck didn't really need Hugo Estelle. It was kind of just a very low cost way to smooth out the draws a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Since the deck incidentally wanted to play mostly 1/3 jobs anyway.
Yeah. The canon comparison there is in Legacy before the companion nerf and before the companion bans, there was a build of elves that could sideboard into It could sideboard between Lurrus and some other companion I don't remember right now.
Gigantha?
I think it was Gigantha, yeah. And it was, you could board in or out of natural orders, depending on the matchup.
That's pretty sweet.
And then, and the premise basically just being, you know, there are some matchups where you want one, there's some matchups where you want the other, and there's some matchups where you don't care about either. And the power level of the companions at that point in time was just so insanely high that you can get away with that. So,
you know, I'm glad we got those couple weeks of busted companion shenanigans, because I think it led to some really cool stuff. I think everyone would agree with me. It's just that, like, it wasn't going to be sustainable.
It's good that we got it out of our system. I will definitely agree with that.
I'm going to smile because it's over and because it happened. That's how I look at it.
So, meanwhile, in terms of the deck, I'm on this GP. I didn't run back Rug Tempo for the third GP, and part of that was the fact that I was picking up on the fact that a lot of people seem to want to play Rug Tempo, and a couple of people didn't end up being on it. I know both Ricky Rickster and Time Spiraled both were considering playing the deck and ended up audibling away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, I basically want to avoid playing that Flash Mirror for as long as I possibly can, because I think I think it is a mirror that simultaneously makes you think that, you know, oh, I outplayed my opponent so hard, like, you know, I big-brained them, while actually being so tremendously just who got first and whose hand is better.
Yeah, that's
because
fair.
Because of just how the decks are tuned. And I'm sure there are edges to be gained, and, you know, someone with a better understanding of, like, knowing there's some really cool Magic games that come out of it. But I also think there's some really salt-inducing games where it's, like, literally nothing I did mattered, because my opponent just had the answers to everything that I was doing, and I couldn't not play into it.
I think there's being on draw and being on play in basically any deck that runs Cosmic Sinkhole.
I agree with that.
Like, it's kind of hard to get away from, but yeah.
I have a great sense of it, trying to be fairly powerful and proactive. We've mentioned before that control is really underplayed, even if you're counting some of these decks as control that aren't being initially classified as control. And some types of combo, like Casino Scam, feel underrepresented. So, with all of those things in mind, I was like, oh, let's play Dreamsight well control. So, I sleeved up 140 of my favorite cards in the format, including 3 Xerix and some new Reveal Eternities. I got to run a Corpse Bed, which is something I didn't do historically in Dreamsight. And let me tell you, that card is so free in an 140-card deck, it's insane. As well as a sideboard Sheikah's Redoubt, because this version runs Void Portal, which is... There are matchups where you can't get a Void Portal down, and those are the matchups where you're already winning, so it doesn't matter. Like, you already have plenty of cards and plenty of things to do with those cards. Or, like, plenty of mana to, like, leverage those cards. But in the matchups where Void Portal is good, it is just take-over-the-game insane.
Yeah.
Luckily, people
run ways to deal with it, but still, like...
Yeah. No, absolutely.
If it doesn't get countered, you do get at least one free transmute.
Yeah.
Which... Can you discard lands?
Yes.
Okay.
You can discard lands to find CMC zero things, which is why I'm running Sheikah's Redoubt in the sideboard. Because it means that any of my lands can become Sheikah's.
I feel like that should just be in the main.
Yeah, I mostly didn't want in the main because I already had Corpse Bed, and I have a lot of other lands I could find that I'd be happy to find.
I'm actually running one Sheikah's Redoubt in my main. I have no intention. I'm just like, I was like,
get them.
Well, it was kind of just when I decided to go up to 24 lands. See, I wanted to play exactly 23 lands, but I can't because Holcomb doesn't let you. So I was like, hey, this card basically like can be a land if I need it to be, but it's also a spell. back to Dreamsight though. I think that Void Portal definitely does a lot for the deck. It's like, it doesn't really solve the deck's weakness, which is basically like you need to spend some amount of initial tempo to cast Dreamsight well, and if you're assuming that you're tutoring for it every game, then the cards closer to like 4 mana, draw 5 cards.
Yeah.
Because you have to take 2 turns. Like, it's 5 mana over 2 turns. So it becomes like less good than you might necessarily think. But like, also when you invest the rest of your deck into, you know, hard control tools, then you can often just be like, okay, 1 for 1U, 1 for 1U. Oh, you're out of cards, draw 5. Okay, game's over.
Yeah.
And
I think Xerix was also a really huge pickup for this list.
Yeah.
Because Xerix gives you this kind of ongoing source of card advantage while also being stapled to a board wipe.
Yeah.
And that's just an insane effect. I think Xerix is one of the best walkers in MSEM, having played like 6 games with them. And this deck might not be the best Xerix deck in the world, but it is a good one.
I think it's pretty close to being the best Xerix deck, honestly. I'm kind of struggling to think of a better one.
I would say a deck that gets to run more effective copies of Xerix. The fact that I can't tutor for Xerix with any of my tutors, and I only run 3 copies and 140 cards, makes me a little bit hard-pressed to call this the best Xerix deck.
Oh, but, okay. Yeah, it's fair enough. You just need to run more 4-drops.
Yeah, that's true. That's how I'll solve my tempo issues, running more 4-drops. Before the GP, I was able to squeeze in a league run with this deck, and was able to get a pretty clean 5-0. I mentioned earlier playing against Dork in Distress, and I lost game 1, and then won games 2 and 3. And that was the only game I dropped in that league run. And I 2-0'd a lot of scary decks in the process, so that felt pretty great. Which then like really made me think, okay, I need to just lock in this deck. This is the same feeling I had with Rug a couple months ago. And in terms of my round 1, I was able to play against a cheat-out deck where Xerix, in both games, reanimated a GQ champion to win me the game. So that felt awesome. And just in general, just Dreamsight's plan of I just am nothing but interaction, and I am every type of interaction I could possibly need and ways to find them, feels very good into the types of decks people are currently playing.
Yeah, I think speaking of the meta a little bit, I feel like the past couple months have very much been your meta, because you've always been the kind of person who runs decks that heavily respect the potential for super linear decks, or like just aggro decks in general. Whereas I think other people don't necessarily focus as much on that. They focus more on their deck doing their own thing. So in metas where people are being much more greedy, like in the metas from earlier this year, like in basically what I call like 3-mana Intrepid meta, where there's just like there's all these like Heart of Zadina decks and decks that are aiming to win with Monument of Queens, in all sorts of colors, you know. I think you probably struggled a lot more in that meta, just because if you pack your deck with like nothing but like all this 1-for-1 interaction, then the deck that goes super greedy will like naturally prey on you. So I think right now, like building decks the pipsqueak way is a super good place to be, and just make tons of concessions towards your opponent. Opponents like showing up with something that will kill you quickly, and then like if that is the case, then you get rewarded for that, right? So like, I don't know. That's just a thought I had, but I don't know whether or not you agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I mostly agree. I think that something that has been true basically forever in MSEM is people play with no respect for their opponent and just don't play any interaction. When they do play interaction, they play all this like flexible 2-mana interaction or like 2-for-1, 3 or 4-mana interaction. And it makes people, I think, much more vulnerable to a wide variety of linear decks. I mean, I think that's why MSEM has like this kind of storied history of people showing up with a broken like turn 3 combo deck, just killing everyone in the room and then like moving on. And it's like part of that is, yeah, that deck was, you know, well, that deck was good in ways that we didn't want in the format. But also, if more people had been playing like a pile of interaction, that person probably wouldn't have just clean swept everything. I definitely felt that while playing Dreamsight in League, is I just hit this, like I hit a very wide variety of lists, and versus basically all of them, it was like, oh, cool. Like, I 2-0'd the Persistocrats deck because I just had too much interaction for that deck to handle, and then eventually gassed back up. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, I played against Fifth, who was on Jund Villainy with CL, and just, like, all, you know, Bloodjade Prophet, all of these ways of generating enormous 3-for-1s or 4-for-1s. And the beauty is, in the face of Dreamsight, that doesn't matter. Your opponent resolving a 4-for-1 doesn't matter, because you then just turn around and you resolve a 2-mana 1-for-5, and your opponent's like, Oh, I spent 3 mana on my Bloodjade Prophet and 6 life, and that looks way better. And
imagine spending 3 mana on Bloodjade Prophet. Okay.
I mean, hey, I was corpse betting and memento moriing like there was no tomorrow. I got to
Corpse, so good. People don't play enough Corpse Bed.
I also think people are underplaying Memento Mori right now. Like, Memento Mori kicked so many decks to the curb in my league run. It was insane. I got to Memento Mori a graveyard in response to a CL downtick, and it was just like game winning. Just like get wrecked.
Feels so bad.
I also drew the Memento Mori off a Reveal Attorneys immediately after my opponent had cleared my hand with a duress. So that was just like an extra like level of fuck off.
Yeah, Memento Mori is just such a it's such a free card that gives so many extra percentage points, I feel like.
Yeah, I strongly agree. So I think the types of deck that Dreamsight preys on are really plentiful right now. And also think the sorts of decks that are really good against Dreamsight, no one's playing. So two historically really bad matchups for Dreamsight were Casino Scam, which it was like could not win that match. I only won my match versus JN with that matchup because JN accidentally got a game loss in game three of our like semifinals match because he forgot to make a clue two turns ago. Like that level of like Hail Mary.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the flash decks traditionally. Dreamsight has always been a tap out control list.
Yeah.
And while it does have counter magic and other slow decks have a really hard time versus it. Like there's a video on my hard drive that has been waiting to be edited for literally like a year and a half, maybe 2 years, of me versus Caillou in this like grueling 2 hour long match where he was playing this blue black Ayakin control deck. And I was on Dreamsight. Those sorts of matches also make Dreamsight look really busted because if you don't have pressure and Dreamsight gets to just hit all its land drops, it will eventually get to the point where it can start resolving Dreamsights. But
my question is, are you counting Rugtow here?
Like, so that's the thing, is traditionally the flash decks were greedy as fuck. Like, one of the things that I've talked about on this before is Rug Tempo is an innovation because it runs, like, functionally no 3-drops. Now, in the main deck, it runs 3 powder scatterers, and that's it for 3-drops. Whereas the old Rug, or, like, Bug, Rug, and those various sorts of tempo decks, their best card was Sangjin, because they were playing these 3 and 4-drops and just hoping to curve up to there while applying pressure.
I think and it, those, like...
Yeah, you got
it. I was just gonna say, in a meta where people are running, like, counter magic, Angel of Sugar becomes so much worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because you tap out for Angel, and then it gets countered, and now your shields are down for a turn. Like, that's something that becomes really hard to do. Especially, specifically in, like, a Dreamsight matchup. I guess also if you resolve your Angel, and then you get exanted or whatever, that also hurts pretty bad.
Yeah.
Although, I guess you said Dreamsight is mostly playing at sorcery speed?
I mean, it's one of those things where, like, if you look at Dreamsight, it runs 39 instants and 27 sorceries.
Yeah, but I'm looking at what actually stops an Angel here. There's Exempt, there's Memento Mori, and there's...
Oppress the Weakness, is it? Because that's Hexproof on your turn. Yep, so that card's pretty good versus me.
Angel actually is really good versus Dreamsight.
Yeah. And I think those types of decks in general, the, like, more greedy instant speed decks that intend to kill you at some point, and at some point is sooner rather than later, those sorts of decks are Dreamsight's nightmare matchup because you can just kind of run circles around it.
So you think Dreamsight is good against Rug Tempo specifically because you invested into removal focus on early drops?
Yeah, I think partially that, and also just Rug Tempo is an aggro deck fundamentally.
Yeah.
It's just an aggro deck that gets to play at instant speed.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the other decks are mid-range decks that get to play at instant speed, and the only way Dreamsight gets an edge over mid-range decks is via being able to like selectively choose when to answer and when to develop on its own terms. Whereas those other decks like force you to play to their pace, and they frequently are going to play to a pace that is you don't get to cast Dreamsight well.
Mm. I actually remember my like Pawblade versus Dreamsight match.
Yeah.
That's also
a really good example.
Yeah. Even though I wasn't playing that much counter magic.
No, but you were playing like just enough. Like, that's the trick.
It was like a combination of like a 7-pack of mana dorks plus cheap aggro engines that also generate card advantage plus just enough interaction to like unbalance you when you try to stop it.
And that version of Dreamsight was also very much trying to end the game with this combo finish of playing 5 or 6 mana spells.
Oh, right. Yeah.
which that makes it even more vulnerable to all the things we've been discussing, whereas this Dream Site list is very much a control deck that just kind of will get there eventually. But yeah, that was a lot of words on Dream Site. I think this deck is really good, but I also don't know how long it'll be very good for. But I'm very glad I'm getting to play it in this GP because it seems well-positioned, and I've really been having a lot of fun playing it.
Yeah. Well, we're on different variations of Sultai decks that use...
have weird deck-building restrictions.
Deck-building constraints, but that operate by pretty much the same principle of, like, MCM card pool big, which I think is pretty funny.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, 2 out of 60 is really damn close to 4 out of 140.
It's true, yeah.
All right, I think that'll do it for us. Thank you everyone for listening, and I hope you tune in next week, assuming we can get out another episode then.
Sweet. See ya.